Well,
don't get drunk on the power, Patrick.
Oh, such power.
Hey everybody, this is Vassals of Kingsgrave with a small but perfectly formed Wolfcast for you this week. My name is Vina 007. I will be one of your hosts in this all curator, 100% premium grade, premium quality Wolfcast. We are also joined by Mary.
Hi everyone. Yes, this is Mary, also known as Nymeria. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. And by Patrick.
Greetings. Yes, I thought we might do like a roo, the essence of Wolfcast or something like that. The close, tight, yeah, nucleus.
Yeah, absolutely. You can come join us, join the debate, join the discussion on the Vassals of Kingsgrave Discord server. VOKpodcast.wordpress.com brings you to all the podcasts, and you can also find a link to the Discord. I'd love to see you. And as you'll see from our VOK podcast Instagram, there have been a couple of mini moots recently. In London, New York, and Atlanta, we are a friendly bunch. No serial killers as yet, so do get involved. Right, over to episode 8, count 'em 8 of House of the Dragon, called The Lord of Tides. Sometimes we do this where we go by character, but I think today, just because it felt like the action layered upon itself, the character development, the mood of the piece evolved through a very tightly written episode, we should probably go scene by scene. But before we do that, remember, people listening, that we could spoil anything in the published works of George R. R. Martin and this show and Game of Thrones up until the point where it diverges from his published work, so up until around season 5. So only listen if you want to be spoiled to this show. It is worth saying that we do sometimes talk about stuff in Fire and Blood, the book upon which this is based, as it surpasses this show. So if you don't want to be spoiled for that, maybe don't listen to this. Okay, let's kick off in time-honored fashion with our lemon cake ratings out of 5. Just to be clear, because Rings of Power cast has had some confusion about the number of rings. So, Patrick, how much did you stan or not stan this episode?
I really enjoyed it. There was a few things that I found annoying, but in general, it had really good bones. I think I'm around a 4 lemon cakes. Maybe 4.25 thereabouts, but it had everything. It had a bit of intrigue, a bit of violence, which I like. It was close enough to what I like in the books. I am a book purist mostly, so if it's too far from the books, I get annoyed and say it's different. So I was well pleased.
Well, that is good. I'm pleased you're pleased. Mary, did you die or did you not die for this episode?
Oh, my heart broke into a million pieces because it's so sad, isn't it? Like, you've got a glimmer of hope and maybe everyone is going to be happy and friendly again. And of course not, because it wouldn't be that interesting. But I found it well acted. Like, there were scenes of such tension and animosity. And yeah, so I'd give it a 4.5. Yeah, I really liked it. The only thing I could maybe say is that it was a weirdly slow pace compared to the previous weeks, I guess. Basically no action, which is interesting too, but can be a bit disorienting. But yeah, a very good episode in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I was watching it so transfixed by Paddy Considine's performance, the beautiful character drama that we were seeing play out before us. It was going to be a 5 for me, but I had to just dock it half a point at the end for some of the prophecy related stuff. So for me, it's a solid 4.5. That is tasty. It was just a really, really good episode. Amazing writing. It's just operating at a level of sophistication that I think things like Ringcast can't even get close to. Not Ringcast, Power of the Rings, Rings of Power. You know what I mean? There's a lot of fantasy.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I completely agree with you, Bina. The ring cast or the power rings or whatever it was is nothing like this. I don't know yet. Actually, I haven't watched it yet. So, but this is definitely better though.
I agree. Like, I was just thinking that just when you said it, Bina, just the writing is like, it's can't compare the in Rings of Power. I mean, we're not here to specifically discuss the two shows against one another, but yeah, it's very clear when you watch that kind of episode, you know what's missing from Rings of Power, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And we shouldn't compare, but then again, I feel the studios, by putting them up and programming them against each other and therefore making our lives very busy right now, are kind of inviting that comparison, right? They've invited that competition. But yeah, there is a level of writing, and I feel that now we're reaching sort of episode 8, we're really seeing the payoff of a lot of the character work they did early on, and a lot of laying the ground on how different characters and political situations interact. So excited for the final two episodes of this series. I think it's really good. Okay, let's get into it. So we're going to do it scene by scene. So apologies, folks listening, if this becomes tedious, but I feel it's layered. So we are going to go with the layering. So we open 6 years later. Some of the kids who are now rather despicable looking teenagers. We are in a situation where apparently there is another uprising in the Stepstones again, and Corliss, basically, he's going to die of septicemia, who knows. But anyway, this raises the issue of succession. He had said in the previous episode that he wanted his grandkids to, Lucerys or Luke to inherit, because he didn't want bastards to inherit. So that obviously throws a cat among the pigeons. And so the family go to King's Landing to basically stake their claim. Queen Rhaenys obviously going to be very important in that. And then we get a note from Baela, Daemon and Rhaenyra, who is pregnant, also go to the Red Keep. And we notice when we get there that it has been redecorated. So we now have 7 pointed stars everywhere rather than Targaryen sigils. The High Towers, father and daughter, are clearly the ones who are ruling, because the king is now incredibly ill. Is Corlys dead? Maybe we should just discuss that now.
I don't even remember if he's actually dying at this point in the books, because I'm terrible. I think the whole irony of it is that he's not gonna die, and so this whole succession debate will have moved the plot further along, but is actually pointless because he's not gonna die yet, in my opinion. But that might not be it.
Patrick, any thoughts on the opening setup of this episode? In other words, that before we get to the real succession we care about, we're gonna have this mock trial over the succession of the Stepstones.
Well, I think they did a good job in setting up a premise that could have happened. It doesn't make any difference to the show or to the books whether or not Corlys might have had a wound in battle at some point. It sort of brings forth what they need to have, you know, have present in their minds going forth, because we assume that Viserys is not long for this world, and then the true war or tumultuous period will commence. So not having the events that was actually in the books with the ball and the two dresses, which they actually in this one later on we'll see that had, they sort of got a premise for you know, getting everyone together and having them be nice towards each other and stuff like that. So I think it's a good premise. They did a lot, and it's believable.
Okay, great. All right, then I agree with you guys. I think it's sort of, I mean, we may well get another occasion when the girls are wearing their coloured outfits. But I liked this. I thought it was clever writing to have a sort of a mock succession where everyone knows that really it's all about whether or not Viserys will finally admit that his daughter has had bastards. So I thought it was really elegant the way they approached it. So I really appreciated it. Okay, so let's get into the shock of seeing Viserys. It is kind of amazing seeing Alicent with him. I mean, he looks horrific. He looks pallid. He's got ligaments on show. There's a hole in his cheek. I mean, half of his teeth are gone. He's kind of rotting while alive. But Alicent does kind of minister to him. Maybe she needs him alive because she's not entirely sure of her power. I mean, she's got it pretty sweet at the moment. House Hightower very much is in charge. So, but she's not, for someone who's in a political marriage, she is at least tending to him, I guess. And I guess Rhaenyra will acknowledge that later in her speech. Thoughts on Alicent at this moment, or Alicent in the Hightowers, and our first sort of view of what has happened to Redkeep in the intervening 6 years, maybe?
I think the episode was interesting in that regard, that at the beginning we're made to think that she doesn't actually care for Viserys. We don't see her with him in the beginning of the episode. When Daemon and Rhaenyra arrive, it's like he's been left in this room alone for God knows how long, and it's not clear that Alicent or Otto Hightower are actually even visiting him. And the whole changing the, like, getting rid of all Targaryen things, and in the castle, is we're definitely made to think that Alicent believes that she's in power, she has won in a way, and she's consolidating her base in King's Landing. And that's why I think the episode is interesting, because we see as we go along that it's not that easy. And even in her mind, it's not, in my opinion, it's not that clear cut. So yeah, not much else to say, but I loved how they brought more and more nuance to the characters as the episode happened.
I agree. I think it's just really great writing and a really great sort of layering of information for us after that 6 year time jump. There's no kind of ham-fisted exposition. It's just done very subtly, and I really appreciate that. Patrick, anything on that before we get to the succession rulings?
I don't think there's necessarily anything that made us like Alicent more in that situation, other than, yeah, maybe she's, well, she didn't kill the handmaiden, so that's good. That would have been Cersei. In a nutshell there. So, but I think they keep on fleshing out that Aegon is not very nice towards the women. It might be important enough to put it, like, to have it being a consistent theme throughout all the episodes. Maybe just so we don't like him too much, or don't sympathize too much with him, because he's going to be a pretty nasty character at some point, at least.
I think it's important for Alicent as well. Like, I think in this episode, part of her is also thinking, I'm fighting for my son to be on the throne, but is it actually such a good idea that this no son of mine? I think that's also why they're pushing this aspect of him.
But maybe she thinks, I mean, I don't know if we have this information to make that judgment here. Maybe she thinks, okay, he is like an adolescent guy who's raping milkmaids, but I can rule through him just as I've ruled through my husband, and I can make it okay. I can wait for him to mature. I mean, I don't think we have the information to allow her that free pass, but it is interesting as a potential softening of her character if she's thinking along those lines. But yeah, it is interesting how 6 years makes... It's kind of interesting, I feel, that we'll get there, but that Daemon and, or certainly Rhaenyra's kids, seem to have grown up to be actually fairly decent, and maybe, like, the non-Targ blood helps in that respect, having yeah, some strong blood in there. Okay, so let's get back to how things are going back in the Red Keep. So Viserys does somehow haul himself to the throne room, and, you know, people are making their petitions about who should take the inheritance, and he rules in favor of Lucerys inheriting Driftmark. Basically, he then says to Rhaenys, well, you know, you kind of say what you think, you've been effectively ruling it in your husband's absence while he's off at war, which I thought was quite, you know, wise and sensible. And I guess this is a good day, because she backs the succession, as so that it feels like there's peace for a while. But she takes up Rhaenyra's offer to betroth Baela to Jace and Rhaenyra to Luke. So it kind of feels like the two women have reached a kind of understanding, an uneasy understanding that will be sealed through marriages, as is ever the case. But Vaemond is pissed off by this entire thing. He's kind of like, you know, what the fuck? We all know, obviously, that her kids are bastards and that she's a whore. Finally, for, you know, Viserys asks someone to say it out loud, and they do in front of him. And Viserys is like, I will not put up with this. I am going to take out your tongue. But Daemon obviously decides to take a rather more swift path to justice. And Vaemond is no more. So, events in the throne room. How do you feel that all went down? Obviously, a lot of nuance there. A lot of power plays. Rhaenyra, Rhaenys. Succession decided, but is it? Feelings on this part?
I knew it was coming. It was quite obvious who was going to do the deed. I would say that the whole succession part where Viserys hobbles in through the throne room was very moving. He does a great job, that actor, what is his name?
Paddy Considine, yeah. All the lemon cakes to Paddy Considine.
It's so good. And I was moved by the solemnness and the strength he portrayed in that situation. And then when Viserys, he helps him up the throne. He wouldn't take help from any other people than his brother. Sort of, again, reconciling a little between those two.
Mm.
And then Viserys and Daemon, they think the same. And Daemon does what Viserys wants to do. He is, in this situation, Viserys' strength.
Well, I get the feeling that actually why were they fighting for so long? Because they're very complementary, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like one is cerebral and political and diplomatic, and then the other is action and, you know, physical power. And actually when they're harnessed together, they're moving, and you get a sense that they do love each other, that there is love there.
Yeah.
Or at least I got that sense, and I was kind of surprised by that perhaps.
If Viserys had chosen him as the hand, it would have gone differently. I think maybe some of the animosity is that he was never, the love between them was never really, you know, recognized in the way other than just being, yes, I love you as a brother, but they are two sides of a coin that should have ruled together for a while at least.
Yeah, that's beautifully put.
Yeah, I agree. I liked the development of Daemon and Viserys' relationship in this episode. And I mean, you've said it all. The whole scene is like, there's so much tension when Viserys arrives and everyone is kind of shocked. Everyone is surprised that he would come and scared for him in a way, I feel. Finally, something like played out, but these poor kids, the three strong boys. I mean, not much else to say. I didn't need that much violence in that way, but I guess I'm watching this show, so I might as well get used to it.
And then we move to a dinner, which is really beautifully visually portrayed, I felt. I mean, I thought it was, it reminded me of all those pictures, like the Last Supper, like sort of medieval. I don't know. There's something about the way it was staged that I thought was incredibly powerful. And you realize that Viserys, he's fallen, literally physically falling apart. And yet he is the glue that is somehow still holding this family together while he is alive, but it's so tenuous. And you get this momentary reconciliation that reminds you that this could have somehow worked. And the comment I want to make on this is, once when I was listening to an audio commentary by Kenneth Branagh on Hamlet, and his version of Hamlet as a film starts off very, it's not a gloomy gothic castle, it starts off very sunny, very functional, very beautiful. And he says, you have to see the possibility that this could work to then understand the tragedy when it doesn't. And so I feel the scene was really an important pause to show there was hope, however slim, that we didn't have to have a civil war. So we get to the dinner, and we are invited to toast each other. And it's when Rhaenyra actually does toast to Alicent and, you know, acknowledges that she has been a very loyal, faithful wife to her father. And Alicent actually then seems to acknowledge Rhaenyra's claim and says, you'll be a fine queen, which is really quite something. It's a very moving place to be after everything that we've seen. However, in the generation below, the children, who are variously cousins, nephews, uncles, it's all very confusing. you see the toxicity has now seemingly passed to that generation. We've got Aegon, who we know is apparently a sadist and a rapist. Well, certainly a rapist, if not a sadist. Maybe that's more his brother. He's insulting Jace. You've got Aemond, who I think does come across as quite sadistic, saying that he would beat his little nephews if, well, they're not little, they're the same age, aren't they? They're all peers. There's a suckling pig that is set down in front of Aemond, and then everyone's kind of like laugh. Well, Luke is certainly laughing at what happened in the dragon pit. And then we've got, it's just the whole thing is, it's kind of like just as the mothers are somehow making some tenuous sort of form of reconciliation.
I would have liked it rather than that they just stopped it where everything seemed hopeful.
Wouldn't the kingdom have liked it if that were the case?
No, but seriously, if it had ended hopeful, like with a hopeful note and without the fighting between Aemond and everyone else, really. For people who hadn't watched or read the book, they would have been like a red herring almost. But it
I see. Yeah, brought some tension.
Yeah, and then we start seeing it deteriorate as soon as Viserys dies. I would have liked that a lot. And I think that we had to, well, I understand why we have to see Aemon be a dick, because it's basically very close to...
Because
he is a dick. Yeah, we're meant to see that it's inherently flawed, and it's out of the mother's hands now, this conflict. They might work to save the realm, but I could just really liked everyone's going from that episode, everyone who hasn't read the book, to go from this episode and thinking, well, this looks good, this might actually work, and then everything goes to hell.
Yeah,
I didn't mind the whole infighting in between the cousins / nephews / the Velaryons and the Targaryen boys, but to me it's more the last scene that is unnecessary. I mean that I didn't like. I would have liked it to end on this kind of ambiguous note of maybe it works, but maybe it's already gone too far between the kids and it's not going to stop there. A few things I liked about this scene generally, I was very much convinced by all of the toasts. At least Rhaenyra and Alicent, I felt were sincere, both of them. Yeah. When Alicent says, we're both mothers and we both love our children, I think she means it. I think she it's both a plea to Rhaenyra to not kill her sons, but also a realization that war for the succession means some of them are gonna get hurt. And that maybe it's some kind of nuclear weapon, right? You're like, we both have the power here to make it so none of our children die. If one of us chooses to attack, children are going to die, and it's mutual destruction, right? So
yeah, mutual destruction.
I was very I was moved by that, just to say Helena is the best. Her whole her line about, oh, marriage isn't so bad, he's mostly going to ignore you except when he's drunk, and everyone is like, this is awkward.
I like that Otto was like laughing and said, well said.
Yeah.
weird.
Let's move on.
talking to your grandchild saying, well said, you know. Not having sex that much with your brother is a good thing.
Awkward.
Yeah, exactly. And when she dances with, is it Jace afterwards? And she's just so weird and geeky, and I love her. Like, I mean, she's an innocent in all of this.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely great character. And it is again, it's a testament to some really great writing that they don't have long to establish all these different ridiculous quantities of cousins. And yet we do get their characters right. There is moment for us to appreciate character, which I think is quite an achievement. being fair to them, in an earlier episode, I think some of us had criticized the fact that so many cousins were introduced so quickly that we barely kind of had time to know who was who. But I really feel I have a strong sense of the individual characters now, which it's impressive, I think. Okay, we move onwards and upwards as ever with an alarming swiftness today. This is going to be great. The episode podcast may actually be shorter than the episode of TV. So everything seems, well, if not hunky-dory, then certainly as copacetic as it possibly can be in a world which is within the Game of Thrones. But we then move to Viserys, who, when he's really in pain and on Milk of the Poppy, he can mistake people. And he clearly mistakes his wife for his daughter. So he thinks he's talking to Rhaenyra. He's actually talking to Alicent. He's clearly talking about the prophecy and the fact that he thinks that she has a specific destiny to protect the realm in the forthcoming Song of Ice and Fire. But the words he uses could be and are misinterpreted by Alicent to make her think that he is giving Rhaenyra the blessing to effectively take out her kids and really rule solely and alone. And
is that what she understood? I mean,
how would you interpret it? Because I don't know. I mean, I've read it once, so you tell me.
I might have been distracted, but the way I understood it was he's like, Alicent believes that he's talking to her and that he's saying Aegon is the prince that was promised and you must unite the realm. You must do what you need to do and unite the realm behind him. But actually, now that I'm hearing your interpretation, I might just have been distracted by the fact that we were supposed to start this podcast and I was already late, so your understanding might be better.
Well, we can now go to Patrick for a ruling on which of our interpretations was correct. Well, don't get drunk on the power, Patrick.
Oh, such power. I think he got her attention with saying Aegon's name. I think that's what happened. And then I think he actually, by mistake, told her that she was the one who could unite the realm, that she was the one who had the power to she was the one who's supposed to be the glue, so to say. And this being his almost very likely one of his last wishes, she was like taking it very solemnly, even though she sort of already made up her mind that she wanted to support Rhaenyra and you know, save her kids and everything. I think that's how I interpreted it.
Yeah, so more like me.
You think that he thinks he's talking to Alicent?
No. He never thought that he was talking to Alicent. He mistook Alicent for Rhaenyra, definitely. But he, by accident, told Alicent that she was the glue. She was the one who's supposed to.
I don't think three different interpretations. I mean, no. I think I agree with. I'm with Patrick. Maybe I didn't explain it in the right way. But I think Alicent doesn't realize that he is thinking that she's Rhaenyra, and so what she hears is you have to do it. You have to unite the realm. Aegon's dream was true, and she believes that it's about her son. And I mean, we wouldn't have this issue if they didn't all call their sons Aegon.
Honestly, yeah. If one of them had just been called Henry or Patrick,
Patrick would be a great name, yeah.
He would not have had a flipping civil war. It's just ridiculous.
But he would be named Patrick Strong, for sure.
Patrick with a Y. Yeah.
It's interesting, because if that's the interpretation, then Alicent, in a sense, it makes Alicent more likable, because she was trying to hold out peace with Rhaenyra and support Rhaenyra, but now she thinks her husband, who is the true-born king, has suddenly said, you've got to do it. But why would logically she think that when all along he's always supported his daughter? Why would she think? Wouldn't she think, okay, he now seems to be saying this to me, but the guy's far gone on Milk of the Poppy?
I mean, she also hears what she wants to hear, right? But I think it does make her, to me, that means that her motivation going forward is going to be to be true to his last wish and some kind of prophecy thing, because I think she gathers in this few phrases that this is rooted in prophecy somehow. And mm-hmm. To me, you're right. Logically, she shouldn't understand that because he hasn't said that once before. But I think he also has not been denying it that much. Like when you see the whole conversation when her Aegon II was born, and everyone being like, "Ooh, that he's maybe going to be the heir. We're going to have a new Aegon on the throne." He wasn't saying, "Yes, that's true," but he also wasn't saying, "Shut up, Rhaenyra is my heir." So I think for all of these years at court, he hasn't been that clear all of the time that he was backing Rhaenyra. He's left some kind of doubt just by omission and not having the and being too lazy to reaffirm her claim every time. So I don't know. I think she shouldn't have understood that, but I think she wanted to hear that, so she did.
You know what? The more I think about this, the more I think if she really did think he was genuinely saying to her, "You are the one," the more I think she's actually her motivation is softer. But actually I think it makes her look rather stupid, because how could you possibly think that after everything that's just happened in the last decade?
But wasn't there like a thing where he said something about, "You asked me something," and what she asked him was about that he actually believed in the legitimacy of Jace and Luke. So by keeping it that vague, she might have thought that he's actually now giving her the right of it, that he thinks that Luke and Jace are not fit to be royalty, and that is why she needs to unite the realm and bring forth Aegon as a king. But let me just say, the prophecy is bullshit. This is so ham-fisted. It's what makes the whole premise of this last bit of the episode, and I think it's a bit cheap. I think they could have done something else and have that being her motivation. Because yes, it in the books she's also motivated by, or she says that he actually told her that his wish was that Aegon would. This is weak. This part, this is why I only gave 4.2, because it's
I agree. I agree, it's a bit weak to invoke the prophecy to achieve that. But also, I think I prefer the story if she truly believes that Viserys wanted this, or that she's in the right, more than some kind of thing based on jealousy, and jealousy that isn't really even understandable, like relatable to me, at least. Like in the previous episodes, I didn't really relate to Alicent, because she was just wanted to tell her to chill all the time, which makes the whole conflict not tragic, but just infuriating, like stupid. You're like, this didn't have to happen. It's just because she's angry and everything's coming from that. And I think this way it brings some tragedy in it. It's not that much better, because it's rooted in misunderstanding rather than anything else. But yeah, I think it's a better story if we can sympathize a bit with her.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I was very conflicted on this, because obviously I hated that they brought up the prophecy in the first place, as everyone else on the Discord pretty much. I felt that, okay, so you brought it up at least to use it.
Yeah.
And at least to use it in a very pivotal way. Like, it wasn't brought up just on a humbug. You had a plan for how you were going to use it. And I've watched TV like the Battlestar Galactica re-up, or even Game of Thrones in certain elements, and even, I would argue, Rings of Power, not to always bring it back to that, but where they do things that are different and you kind of feel you didn't really have a plan with that. That's even more annoying. It was just casual playing in this world that we take seriously, maybe too seriously, but that we take seriously. Whereas here, I'm kind of like, I don't like that you did it. I think it's a weird it's a weird way to motivate your plot when the book itself had good motivations. But at least it was intentional. At least there was thought that went into it. I don't agree with it, but I know that you are not completely pissing on the world. Like, you are trying to respect in some way the world by having a plan. I don't agree with the plan, but at least you have a plan. Because for those people who are old like me and watch Battlestar Galactica, at some point Ronald D. Moore just didn't have a plan anymore. And that was even more frustrating and disrespectful to the audience. So Yeah, that's all I want to say on that. And maybe we shouldn't say more on that because it's dangerous territory. But, the whole season so far is why I dock the point. I mean, it's the only reason I ever dock points in this season, effectively. Sorry, Patrick.
But I think it's interesting to talk about what's meaningful changes. What is a meaningful change? Why does some changes feel okay and some changes feel wrong somehow to the spirit of the source material? As I said in the beginning of this episode, when we started summarizing the first part of this episode, I think it was, I don't mind when it makes sense, when it's within the spirit of the characters, they react as they would have, and it's been foreshadowed what happens. It's the out of the blue situations where everything is sort of like they just needed something to happen for the plot to move on, and that's weak. And that's the difference between the first bits of that's been changed, and I'm not sure whether or not there's going to be a green versus black scene other than this one we just got, because so I don't know. There's going to be a lot of changes, I think. Those are fine as long as they're within the spirit and they still, you know, hit the points, like the beats. But this last bit, it was a bit weak, and they could have done it in a number of different ways. Of course, I'm not a professional writer, so I'm a bit poor for suggestions right now. But I could definitely, in the amount of time that they had to write the script, find some other solution than that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's valid. And I don't want to predict what our brethren at Dragoncast are going to say, but I would imagine they would have thoughts on this as well. It is the bone of contention in the episode, right? I mean, so much is so good here with the acting and everything, but this really is the point where people can say, okay, I see you took a gamble there on trying to do something interesting, but it's just not working for us. I think that's really valid. Is there anything else you'll want to say about this episode that we haven't done yet in terms of plot, thematics, how it looks?
I actually had a thought about the fact that they went through so much trouble having two or even three casts for some of the children, which is good. It works out fine. But I think like Rhaenys has looked the same for the past 30 years, basically, or 20 if it's 20. But
how have I, Mary? Haven't aged a day. Still look 25. But you're right. You're right.
Yeah, no, like her and Damon just are and look just the same. And I mean, I guess it's also part of the. It makes us realize how much Viserys, how ill he is. That in comparison to Damon, Damon still looks 25, and and Viserys looks like he's 70. But I thought it was a bit too much.
Yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I think she even has the same haircut. Like, do you notice like fashion doesn't change in this world, which sounds really superficial, but you know, it is another way to indicate the passing of time, which they're not seemingly worried about.
Yes, exactly. They could have just done a few things to make her and maybe Damon and even Otto look a bit older in these episodes that they do at the very beginning, which is like 20 years before that. So, yeah, or even more, because like, I don't know how old Rhaenyra is at this point, but she has 14 years old, so children, I mean, so yeah.
Yeah, I think that's valid criticism. Patrick, anything else from you on this episode, or anything else really?
Yeah, I think I was a bit confused why they had to put in Massaria again.
Yeah, that was interesting. What was up with that?
I don't know.
To remind us that she exists and yes, she's going to be a player. I mean,
hey, look at her. She knows someone.
Introduced her a few episodes ago, and she's still here. Yeah.
And what does that knowledge that Aegon is a floundering flout, a rapist? Yeah. What does that necessarily help her?
Misaria, I don't think it helps her per se. I think the way they're portraying her is that she knows everything. She's like collecting secrets on everyone and then selling them, and that's her business. Which like I think is not a bad portrayal.
I think it was literally, we just have to remind you she still exists because something's going to happen at some point, so just remember she's around.
In a consistent way with what we've seen from her in the previous in the season, really.
I know it would actually somehow maybe have detracted from it, but couldn't we maybe have seen the handmaiden at Misaria's or something like that, something more meaningful than just, oh my god, the person who knows about this is going to Misaria. She's also an informant. Wow.
I think it's better with this woman who seems to be kind of trusted by Alicent. The fact that she's setting secrets, I think, didn't bother me at all. Actually, it was a short enough scene that you can understand that it plants seeds for the rest of it, but it doesn't take me out of the episode.
No. If you close your eyes, you might have missed it though.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid. I mean, I didn't even mention it in the recap, right? So, I mean, that tells you something. I think it's literally them just planting the seed because maybe there's some setup later in the season or the hook that takes you from one season to the rest. I mean, I think that's probably what's going on with that. Nothing more kind of interesting, so to say. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Well, it kind of feels we've come to the natural end of what we in general thought was a good episode in a generally good season, bar prophecy stuffs. Hope you enjoyed it, listener, and we will be back next week. We hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are. Feel free to join us on the Vassals of Kingsgrove Discord server to have a chat. In the meanwhile, stay nerdy. The wolf pack is diminished. That was a diminished Aru for sure.
As strong as ever.
We can still fuck shit that when we want to.
I mean, you have to cut some of them out in a way just so that it doesn't saturate, so.
I will keep as many in as I want, so.
Patrick, are you okay, Ted? I could probably do this tonight, actually. This was incredibly quick, and with only three of us, it's a fairly fast edit.
Yeah, and actually only a few fuck ups, so not a lot.
Yeah, just take me like fucking up anyone. It was only one real fuck up, but it was a big one. I mean, I went for it with maximum force. In the aforementioned fuck up. No fuck ups went uncovered, right? I mean, it was, yeah.
When you do, you commit. It's true. Cool. Can talk about myself again if you like.
No. It's okay. I think we can crack on with the show.
I can do something blah 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 Vikings blah 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 Viserion.